Welcome to From the Ground Up with Mark Weller. I'm Matt Rienzo here with Mark Weller. Mark, how are we feeling today?
Oh, man, Matt, couldn't be better. Things are so good.
I know, it's crazy. Got a lot going on, but everything's great. So we do have another great show for you today on a topic we haven't honestly talked too much about recently: golf course, clubhouse, and residential development all mixed together. So we're excited to talk about that today with Troy Miller of Southworth. Southworth has worked on some of the most remarkable projects of this type. They're working on the Abaco Club in the Abacos, Bahamas, Creighton Farms in Virginia, Willow Bend in Cape Cod, just to name a few, and there's others we'll hear about. Mark, it's a really cool company, very interesting projects. We've gotten to know Troy a little bit over the last year or so. He's a great guy, very accomplished in this field of golf and community development. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, I think what Troy does is, and his company does, is so unique in the sense that they create these incredible experiences and places. There's only a few companies out there really doing it at this level. Their main focus tends to be club or around club and golf. And Troy will tell us more about that, but it's remarkable and there's a lot to be learned. And what was most fun, we got to spend the day down in, North Carolina with Troy. And I learned so much just in that day with him. So it was really great. And I hope we can share some of that today.
No doubt. All right. Well, let's invite Troy on.
Hey Troy, how are you?
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Great to see you. You look great. And our audience can't see you, but I can through the screen, and you're looking good. You ready for the holidays?
I am. I am ready for the holidays. I'm fresh off a trip from Abaco. Got in late last night back to Charleston home, and I'll tell you, I get to travel the world a lot, but every time I come home, I realize there's no place like Charleston.
Yeah, Charleston. That's right. Charleston is awesome. I hope it's one of my goals. One of my career goals is to eventually do something of importance or significance in Charleston. Worst case scenario, maybe I'll just buy a house down there near you.
Hey. Yeah, that's a great option. Yeah. All right, well, let's jump into it. Troy, let me just ask the first question. You know, you and your team do some incredible work. Before we get into too much, I'd love for you just to tell us about Southworth. Tell us about how you're reimagining private club experiences and so on.
Absolutely. So Southworth is a 35-year-old company. Southworth Development started in the early 90s and started with projects like Willow Bend on Cape Cod. And David Southworth, and at the time, Paul Fireman, the founder of Reebok, was the financial arm behind Southworth. Through the 90s and early 2000s, the company's been through a few reinventions, but always with the same focus of community, amenitized community development, primarily focused around golf. And so this company to me is very similar to, I had the great fortune of working for Landmark Land Company back prior to my time with Southworth, who was kind of the granddaddy in this field, predating Discovery and others that did this type of development. But a very similar company with Southworth in terms of our vertical integration. We do everything. We are womb-to-tomb developers who operate, own, develop, design, construct, sales, marketing, legal, accounting, everything under one roof, all pulling on the same end of the rope, which is a very rare thing in the space. And so the ability to focus all of those things and kind of be the keepers of the vision across all of those different platforms, and having a tremendously talented team of executives around us in each of those different in those different sectors, really, I think is one of our big competitive advantages.
Definitely is unique. By the way, I was just going to jump in on that, because you start to get to know really the details, the inner workings of some of these other companies out there that are really doing amazing work, but very few, if any of them, are actually are doing it soup to nuts like you all are. And you know, everything from concept and acquisition all the way through operations, right? And greeting the customer at the door and holding that customer for years.
That's right. And I think that's something we used to talk about a lot, is this idea that when you've got a land planner in Arizona and a golf course architect in Florida and a sales and marketing team in Chicago and a building architect in New York, what you get is kind of a mediocre product and a bad game of telephone and a really big FedEx bill. And so having everybody kind of working together in the same place, one of my early stories as a golf course architect was working on a project called Apes Hill Club in Barbados.
Where I love Apes Hill. I've played there a bunch. I love that place.
Phenomenal spot. And we, you know, we were looking at this one hole, this golf hole with a tee that was up high in elevation. You could see both the Atlantic and the Caribbean. And we were talking about it, and sitting at my back was our real estate development team and our real estate sales. And they kind of went, that tee is not going to go there. That's a $2.5 million lot. And I said that, so this just became a short par four, and it's going to go down the hill a little bit here. And so it's that give and take, and trying to find the absolute, trying to maximize the value of every project is really the way that I look at this, and having that control. Like most developers, we don't want to control everything, just everything our land touches. And for us, it's not just about that, but also about how we interact, how it works organically to grow the operations of what happens on the land and the community, and building that community, which is really at the core of what we're all about at Southworth.
Yeah, let's jump on that topic. What's tell us about the Southworth way. You know, I know you're big in building community, and I've read a little bit about it, but tell the listeners what the Southworth way means.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that actually drew me to this company. And Tommy Southworth, our president, is something that he's worked hard on in this new iteration of the company as we really try to scale up and grow. The idea that there is a code of conduct between our members and the way that they treat our employees, and vice versa, and the way that our employees treat our members, and that we're both held to a very high standard. And
I love that.
You know, some people might just call it the no a-hole rule, but, you know, for me, it has been something that's been tremendously valuable to creating the right environments in our clubs so that you are creating community, and knowing that we're getting the right kind of people, because the people part of this, the sticks and bricks of what we do are great, but if you don't have the right people interacting in those spaces, you're never going to build community. And right. So this is our way of making sure that we continue to maintain the right community as we grow and as the communities evolve and mature.
I love the way that you kind of categorize that two-way respect from, you know, the people to the people working there. I think that's something that's clearly lacking in a lot of clubhouse environments. So I think
although you notice the best clubs you're ever going to go to, whether it's golf or just overall family country club type environments, they all, you'll notice there, if it's a really positive, enjoyable place, there's a lot of respect going both ways. Like that.
Yeah,
that's what I found.
That's great.
So that it's great that you implement that, and it's not all about the dollars. Yeah. It's all about the entire experience. And that's great. You're a member here, but you have to show respect. And obviously that creates and breeds that respect amongst the teammates that help create what the experience is. And you know, from our own experience of opening hotels and other things, you know, we build the most beautiful buildings. I really do believe that we do, it, just like you do, and many developers do. But they're nothing without people, and they're nothing without personality of the people, and all of that. And I learned that from the Firstmans and Alan Firstman, and just watching how they took the Pendry in particular to life and brought it to life with the personality and the hospitality and just the overall attitude that came from the teammates that worked inside the project just changed. It actually makes the building more beautiful, right?
That's right. 100%. I think there's so much to be learned from that. And those kinds of environments that are most successful, they bring an energy and a warmth. And Abaco, I mentioned, you know, I just left there. And every time I'm there, the thing that I'm struck by is the relationship between the employees and the members. And the way that the warmth of the hugs that happen upon the return to that place is something that is valuable, at the end of the day. And so it's an important thing to focus on. And from us, from our perspective, trying to create those connections, there are ways for us to control it as we, you know, in an architectural way, in a design way, in a programming way. Mm-hmm. We are trying to provide the opportunities for those organic moments for connectivity and for connection and community growth. And so that's a big part of our focus in trying to create a competitive advantage and actually trying to physically measure that. How can we show how we are creating a greater level of connection and a greater level of community in what we're doing. So taking a more scientific approach to stuff that I think has been a vibe for centuries.
Yeah, that's right. It's funny. The Bahamas is something I feel the same way. First time I went down there to visit for our large project down there, I left saying, I want to work around this place. I want to work around the people from here. there's something different down here in the attitude. It seems to be people are born with it, but just I would say a friendlier, more hospitable attitude than maybe in some other places. Or maybe it's because I'm from the Northeast and I've been in the cold my whole life. I don't know what it is. But anyways, you know, zooming out a little bit, big picture question here. You know, golf had a big boom during COVID, you know, and we saw that, you know, all the kids, adults, everybody had more time. Golf courses, particularly in states that were open. I mean, you know, people were driving from Maryland and Pennsylvania just to come to Virginia because the courses were open, et cetera, things like that. Tell us a little bit, is that momentum holding on, or was that a fad, or is it waning, or where does that stand?
Well, I think that certainly we're never going to see the level of growth and demand that we had during COVID. That was an incredible boom for golf. While things have slowed down, I think that golf has still never been more popular. And I think that's been partially due to the evolution of the game through COVID and some of the things that happened because they had to, and some of the things that happened because golf has finally started to evolve a little bit in the ways it needs to be a little bit more interesting to different demographics, growing demographics, and to younger people. There's a lot of ways golf is being played today that's introducing people to the game that wasn't done before. And I think that's going to continue to show growth in the game and growth in the interest in golf and golf communities. What it looks like will be different than it did certainly in the 80s or 90s. So,
yeah, no, that's very true. And I love watching even my own children, especially my sons, have shown such an interest in it and gotten so into it, and their friends, and they all meet up to shoot. They'll just try and go get six or seven holes in after work in the summer or whatever. But that's great. So on your projects, trying to understand a little bit about like where we're going in the recent trends in golf course development, you know, what does the future hold? What do you see? You know, what are you all working on, and where are you pushing towards? The trend of today's golf and what tomorrow's future looks like.
Well, I think one thing certainly, and I lean again back on my days with Landmark, where Landmark actually developed more top 100 golf courses than any developer in history. I think the Kaisers are quickly catching up to that these days. But at that point in the 80s, at Oak Tree Golf Club, PGA West, La Quinta, Mission Hills, Kiawah Island, Palm Beach Polo, all of those projects, golf was the amenity. It was the single source core of everything that went on that created the community. It was the reason people were buying. Today, it is much more diverse than that. And golf is being consumed and is certainly a big part of the amenity set that we create, but it is just a part of it. The interest level, the decision-making process, the ability to spend time in other ways has us all evolving. And obviously pickleball is the fastest growing sport in the world. We're seeing that, you know, we're certainly installing a lot of pickleball around like most developers are in these types of environments. But I also think it is a big time programming push to understand your members and try to connect again, that connection word and creating community. For me, that is the big opportunity for us going forward, is really using data and knowledge, and we are in the best position possible within the hospitality field to do it, because we have a controlled set of people that we know that are coming back time and time again, whether it's your everyday club like a Creighton Farms, or if it's your second home club like an Abaco Club or a Willowbin. We have a dedicated, you know, a set number of people that we should know intimately and be able to make those connections and know what they like, what they want, and be able to react in a way that, you know, general hospitality in a hotel that's a transient audience can't necessarily.
The clubs that you're building though, are they, I understand how they're progressing, but are they generally the same, or are they different based on the geography and the clientele you're trying to attract?
So for us, our goal is, and it's one of the other unique things about the company, we do have reciprocity across all of our clubs throughout the world. So if you're a member of one, you're a member of all, which has us playing in a very narrow slice of the margin. We want everything from a luxury and quality perspective to be very much alike and on that same band. But in terms of the look and feel, we want to make sure to maintain the character and the quality. So we want to set the quality on a global scale from a Southworth, what the Southworth standard is, and then have the character meet us there. So the sense of place of an Abaco club and being in the Bahamas versus a Macrahanish Dunes in Scotland on the West Coast in one of the most rugged Scottish end of the earth place you could ever imagine. We want to have those unique experiences. And as we grow, we want more unique experiences. We're not looking to duplicate the same environment and the same sense of place. We want other interesting environments that our members want to go to. And we want to be able to provide the same level of quality of experience in a different character everywhere they go.
I love it. That is an awesome philosophy. And that is, I mean, it's hard to do though. I mean, there's a reason why there's some very successful groups out there, hotel chains, et cetera, who build the same product over and over, or same, you know, different hospitality groups, same product over and over. It doesn't even change depending on what country it's in or what state it's in. And I always admire the companies that are able to adapt with where they're working, geographically, or where, you know, the differences culturally and so on. And that's a lot more of what you all are focused on while still keeping the quality very high. And that's your consistent, your consistency is in the quality of your service delivery.
So, absolutely. I think, awesome. Maintaining the common threads of all of the clubs at that level of quality is the goal. And then how those threads all get connected in the character of the place they exist is the secret and the sauce that isn't like walking into a building and knowing that, you know, the front desk is going to be on the left and you're going to have five fixtures in a bathroom and the whole thing. It is more about the ethos and the vibe of the place and knowing that you're at home.
Totally.
So advancing that part of the conversation, you know, we've talked a lot about creating community. You develop private clubs and golf clubhouses and communities, but there are also, you mentioned pickleball, you mentioned programming. Talk about some of the variety of offerings in the clubhouses that don't really revolve around golf or that are in addition to golf. Like, you have some developments that don't have golf at all, or they all have some component of golf?
Well, we do have some in the portfolio that don't have golf right now, but I will say our goal moving forward, we have a saying in the company that we've done clubs without communities and we've done communities without clubs, and we don't want to do either one ever again. We really do believe that recipe requires both to be successful. And so we do focus a lot within the clubhouses and the different amenity sets and even the way that golf is consumed, short courses and night golf and all of the cool things that you can do with this big amenity that you have in the middle of your site typically is the way to try to draw others. Clubhouse wise, you know, we've leaned hard into culinary and trying to really bring in experiences, trying to build experiential things for our members to do throughout the year, reasons to come back to the club. And then I think the other thing that we're really doing that I think is unique and helpful is, again, on that connection in looking at ways to get people to interact around food service, around events. And so we've got a director of experience, a member experience that focuses primarily on creating those experiences and interesting events on the sites that allow for people to interact. And, you know, in the sticks and bricks side of things, you know, adding community tables to all of our food and beverage outlets so that people kind of do have to interact and get off their phones and look up and deal with other members and make those human connections. Is a big part of where we're trying to focus our energies going forward.
Very cool. Talk about, you know, you touched on this a little bit, and I think you said talked about the vibe, but that was more in relation to the people once the place is built. Talk about the process by which you identify a site, decide what community or club goes there, you know, what actually goes where on the site, et cetera. Talk about that. Is it a science, more of an art? I'm sure it's a mix of both, but talk about how you get to that final vibe that you like.
100%. Yeah, it is a mix of both. And this is where my heart and passion lie, really, is in the land planning piece and the architecture side, because it is about, first and foremost, finding extraordinary places in the world. You want to find natural beauty and not screw it up. The ability to walk onto a site and figure out what the best attributes of that site are and figure out how to program them in a way that they can have the most touch to the most individuals that will come in contact with it. So for me, from a land planning perspective, there's a lot of math that goes into it, understanding how many units we're looking to create within any given program, how we lay out golf, how we lay out amenities, what amenities work and what markets, has a lot to do with what are the feeder markets, what is in demand in those markets, and then what is the culture of the place that we're in. Again, that sense of place is so very important. So that process starts with a land plan, always for me. Whether it's on a piece of, you know, trash with a bubble diagram and writing down some numbers about units and putting some marks on a paper where you want to have that family pool center and the and your fitness and your golf club and your pickleball and racket facilities and all of the amenities that we continue to add to these communities, figuring out what that vibe is and what the unique things about the site can be. And then as it evolves and we refine, then you start to really dig in down into the nuts and bolts of how do people utilize it? How do we live on these sites and product development and conceptually planning out and programmatic floor plans for the first units that, again, my hope is that we're creating turnkey product on the ground in these units that is somewhat of the gateway for people to come in and make this their home that they're going to want to grow in with their family over time. So maybe it's a 3-bedroom, 3.5-bed cottage that they're going to come spend weekends, but then they're going to want to move on to the larger spec home or to the estate lot where they can build their custom home that becomes the home where the whole family comes and extended family comes every year for Christmas or for 4th of July. And so that's that vision of figuring those pieces out is huge for us. And again, because of how we're trying to grow as a company, we think about dots on a map. And so we want to make sure the places that we're looking offer something unique to our 2,500 or so members around the world that they don't already have within the network to be able to go to, because we know they'll be our biggest supporters when we do go there and likely the first rung of buyers that we'll have.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's great to have that built-in base. And that's what's so neat about holding your projects long-term. And everything you think about, you think long-term, you think of the customer as a lifetime customer. So, you know, going back, talking about you for a second, I just want to focus on you because, you know, you have a really interesting background. You know, you were a golf course architect. I'm sure you went to we could talk about that, how you went to school. Yep. And then, you know, now you're a developer. And, you know, it seems like a normal, easy transition, but it's not. You're going from the creative and sort of the artistic side of the business over to really the business side of it. And then you're trying to merge all that together. And I think, you know, as we know in this world, this business is really more art than it is science. And so, you know, but you have to find that ability to do it. It's not the easiest transition, but you did it and you're running this unbelievable operation. You've been developing products for years now. Tell us about how that happened and how it started in school and how you got to where you're at now.
100%. Yeah. So I grew up in the golf industry. My father's a golf professional. And my first brush with golf course architecture was when I was 9 years old with Pete Dye, building the ocean course at Kiawah Island. And I got to build a relationship with Pete, got to work with him.
At nine, you built a relationship with Pete Dye?
So Dad and Pete shared an office while they were building the ocean course. And Pete used to take me out on the golf course in the afternoons. And this was, father tells the story much better. But as a 9-year-old punk kid, I'm standing in a bunker with Pete and he goes, "What do you think?" And all I can see is the sky. And I'm looking up and this thing's 6 feet deep. And I said, "Well, why didn't you make it deeper?" And he calls the guy over. We scoop 2 more feet out of the box. He goes, "What do you think?" I said, "That's good." And so it was early on that I really kind of caught the bug and got to see how golf courses get built. And then was really fortunate to work with a lot of the best architects in the world throughout my late teens and early 20s. And it came time to go out in the world. So I got my master's in landscape architecture at the University of Georgia, taught golf course architecture at UGA as well.
You went to for landscape architecture.
That's correct. Yeah.
Is that a natural course? Is that a natural path to get into golf?
It generally is. It's such a niche field. There's really only about 800 golf course architects in the world. And
that's
so
right,
there's not a program. University of Edinburgh has somewhat of a program. There's not really a definitive field for it. Landscape architecture is the best fit, where you get the land engineering piece to understand drainage and how to move dirt, as well as the architectural features and kind of the visual piece of it.
Yep.
So, and it was interesting too, you know, I had an undergraduate degree in math, kind of have an engineering brain anyway. That was one of the things that I feel like I was probably at an advantage to some of my classmates that really came from pure art side, coming into landscape architecture, not sure. necessarily understanding the nuts and bolts. But and that's why I stayed and taught. I taught land engineering and golf course architecture for a short period. And at that point was probably destined to go into a shop working for in a design shop for one of the golf course, one of the large big name golf course architects in the world. And it, and for me, it didn't feel right. I wanted not to cut the ribbon and walk, you know, draw the plans, build the place, cut the ribbon and walk away and have it and just wonder what happened. So the opportunity to go to work for Landmark Land Company in-house as a golf course architect and actually get to see the process through and then own it and watch it grow organically and be able to react to what worked and didn't work. And also to try to maneuver it in the right directions when necessary to make sure that it was being operated the way you wanted. So that was the real draw. And I think the draw for a lot of folks that come from the design side and get into development is that ability to watch a project mature and grow organically. Because I can tell you, you got to have a plan and you got to be willing to change it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, watching how things grow organically and change has been some of the best education for how to figure out what these projects need to look like when you first step foot on them than anything I could ask for. And I was exposed to a lot in the first, I always tell people, because I kind of came out of school in 2005, I got to see the best and the worst that our industry will ever be in the first 5 years of my
life. Yeah, I bet.
And there's a lot of benefit to that. I was with a company with Landmark that a lot of our associates, a lot of our senior leadership was of an age. You know, it was a 35-year-old company at that point that they weren't ready to go through another recession, and certainly not the Great Recession. And so there was a lot of folks that walked, and I just started collecting titles to some degree because of that. And so that was a great education in and of itself, starting to pick up the operational experience, the development experience, the construction experience, doing a lot of those jobs and the acquisition and looking at all of these projects in a wider lens than just routing a golf course and trying to figure that out. And so working for a developer gives you that breadth of information and the opportunity to do different things. And that's how my evolution really happened, was this idea that golf was just part of it. The greater community is where you can really mold something and create a place. And to me, that is that's one of the most humbling and rewarding experiences that you can have.
Yeah, I bet. And so with that, what are your favorite phases of working on these projects? Like what's the most fun for you?
Well, yeah, ground up is a blast. It's really hard, but it's a lot of fun. And being able to build something out of nothing is phenomenal. And at Apes Hill in Barbados, we got to experience that with Landmark in the mid 2000s. Great timing. You know, we had a lot of those opportunities early on. And now really with Southworth, a lot of our projects are about taking these projects to the next level and trying to create that value add and trying to take them from the fifth inning to the ninth inning. And like at Abaco, we've got a ton of runway. We're roughly about a third built out there in terms of the width or the how long this project will be. And so we've got another 10 years of a master plan, which is also exciting. That's the other part that I really like, looking out into the future and saying, all right, in 10 years, we're going to have three times as many people on this site as we do today. We're going to need more amenities. We're going to need more things for people to do. And we're going to want these experiences, not the centers of body heat have to change and have to multiply in order to provide for that. And so the long-term planning piece of it is certainly where a lot of the vision comes in and the excitement over that. And then for me too, just, getting to talk to the operators and figure out what works and what doesn't and where we need to adjust. Those are great opportunities for to call audibles and say, we thought it was going to work this way. It doesn't. We need to figure out a way that it works for the community that's using it. And so,
do you ever nail it? Do you ever just nail it right when you open? Have you ever been?
Hell no.
No, it's a constant no. adjustment.
I don't think anybody who tells you that they have is lying, but yeah. It's one of those things where, you got to have a plan and you got to be willing to change it. And there's a lot of ways to do that. But that attention to detail, and again, that vertical integration of having everybody pulling on the same end of the rope and knowing who your operator is, because he's your right arm. He's right there with you. That's every right. step of the yeah. way, and knowing what design wanted from the beginning and having that all in house to make sure that every decision that is made in the lens of that overall mission and vision of what we want a place to be.
Yeah, I think sitting up high, the perch that you sit on, and the way you're able to look upon the whole business and draw from all your experiences is what makes you all so successful. And it's amazing. It's amazing to listen to, because I know how much you're drawing from every time you think of a new project or open a new one. And I would imagine because of that, you make a lot less mistakes on design and things like that you probably would have made 20 years ago.
Oh, for sure. There's, you know, I think, and one of the things that I think is really unique, and the industry has changed so much. I tell people all the time, do not build golf to check a box on your project, because it is, you cannot build mediocre golf and survive today. The yeah. level of quality of golf that is being mm-hmm. built in the world today is far superior to that than what it was 25 years ago or 20 years ago. And we got to see that in the recession in 2008. You know, there were a lot of projects that should have never been built. There were some that were just products of bad timing, and now are really successful and are either being redeveloped or have kind of come out of dormancy after a decade of struggle. It's one of those things where today I am. The site leads you. You've got to make sure that what you're doing there fits on the site, and trying to force it is like trying to fight water, and it's a losing battle.
That's really cool. And it's this whole conversation has been really interesting. I love to hear how you think about it. It's funny, Mark, I was thinking about when he was saying, you know, the long-term future planning, like the 10 years. You know, our philosophy is we want to do things that are more like 5 years, 6 years, but we have things that are 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, you know, Troy, you're in this for the long haul, so you probably don't care, you know, that these projects take a lot longer. Yeah. Sometimes as a developer, you know, if you can get something done in 3, 4, 5 years, you know, it could behoove you to focus on those things. But since you hold them long-term, that's really the, you know, you have the patience because you're holding them long-term and you're in this for the long haul anyway.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's one of the unique positions of Southworth too. You know, we're Joe Deitch, Commonwealth Financial is the parent company. We essentially act as an arm of the family office doing real estate investment. And because of that, our metrics and what we look at from a business perspective are a little different than mm-hmm. if it was private equity looking for that 5-year turn or an IRR. You know, we are looking at projects in a different lens, and it allows us to be more patient, both in the choice of what we do, as well as in the way that we develop projects. So when I talk about maximizing value, to me, that is a kind of a three-legged stool of quality, time, and cost. And so that maximization of value is about making the best of every square inch of what you've got on a site, and holding the best piece until you're getting that real uplift from what you've done around it. And so, you know, if everything's going to increase by a percentage, it's the stuff that's most valuable is going to increase the most. And so we think about things in a long-term lens for certain.
So this is a question we love to ask, questions like this towards the end, and we're nearing the end of our time together today, but you know, of all of the work that you've done, you know, give us one or two of your more challenging projects, just one, two, whatever you want to tell us, that have turned out to be, you know, unbelievable experiences and unbelievable products at the end. If you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit with us about that.
Well, you know, one that I think is in progress, but is certainly ranks up there from a challenge perspective for us, is Abaco. Working in the Bahamas is difficult, to say the least. I've had the great fortune of working on four different continents and in a lot of Caribbean islands and in the States in many different jurisdictions. And I can't say that I've dealt with a more difficult place to develop than the Bahamas. That being said, I believe in this project, because of the physical beauty of it and the diversity of the site and our opportunity there. And I look at kind of the different phases of a project. You've kind of got the infancy phase of trying to get up and running. Well, we've blown through that. You get into this kind of growing pain phase of growing the project. And now I think we're really entering into that capitalization of the project and being able to see great things happen and gain that momentum through greater sales, greater growth in a shorter period of time. And so I think that Abaco is one that's really going to be one of those, boy, it was hard, but boy, was it worth it. Mm-hmm. Macrahanish Dunes in Scotland is another one, tremendously challenging because, especially from the golf perspective, because of the fact that it is in the most sensitive environment, and the SSSI, the Scottish and the UK, the environmental regulations that we deal with there, that golf course was built without moving much more than a spoonful of dirt. It was discovered. And it is of the highest environmental level that you could have. It's been touted as the most environmental golf course in the world. And so the discovery of a golf course is both super exciting for a person like me and also difficult, but creates a whole different unique environment that we don't have otherwise. That in a world where, you know, dozers and moving dirt rule the day, to go in and discover a golf course on a great piece of land in an incredible environment is one that is tremendously rewarding and I think unique and will continue to be unique in the world, that gives us scarcity value as we move forward and start into the next iterations of that project.
Yeah. And it's funny that you bring up scarcity. And I think that's what, you know, and hopefully in most cases that I've experienced so far, the hardest stuff that we've worked on, the more difficult, challenging places to work, whether, you know, for a variety of reasons, tend to be the best projects when you're finished. And you just described two places with two different variation of issues, but they both are turning out to be fantastic. That's great. That's a great answer. I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it seems like we're out of time, unfortunately. Troy, this has been awesome. Really insightful conversation. I think people are going to love listening to this. And great to see you again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much and have a great holiday.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Matt. Happy holidays to both of you. And thanks for having me on.
Congrats on everything to you and your company. And we look forward to working together and speaking more in the future. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
That's going to do it for us today. A big thank you to Troy Miller of Southworth for being with us today. And if this episode was of interest to you, definitely check them out at southworthclubs.com. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback. So hit us up on social media at Weller Development on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Rienzo. He's Mark Weller. Keep building, people.